morning, everyone. Nice tiring week. Ready for Shabbos. Okay. So there's a word that Hashem introduces that's a synonym or derivative, an alternate word for Makos, that reminds us that the Makos had a secondary purpose aside from being punitive or penal, aside from being a punishment, aside from trying to break the will of Paro. The Makos were also called Mofes. So Hashem tells Moshe, Ki daber lechem paro lemor tenu lechem mofes, v'yamarta l'aron kachas matcha v'yashlech lefei paro yehi l'tanim. So it's at a very early stage where Moshe is not yet performing a makkah, he's performing a mofes. But throughout Parshas Va'era and Bo, the ensuing makos are sometimes referred to as mofsim. So whatever the Moface is in the beginning of the Parsha, and whatever elements it serves and functions, will also characterize the later Makos. So Rashi interprets Moface here to mean, Os lehodia, sheyesh tzorech b'misha sholech eschem. Namely, a Moface has a theological function, to demonstrate to Paro HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority, whether it's general authority or specific elements of that authority. So the word Moface, in the beginning of Va'era, when Moshe hurls the staff and it turns into a snake, is to demonstrate HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, authority, strength. Well, if the word mofes means that in the beginning of Va'era, referring to this one-off tossing of the staff, then all the makos that are also referred to as mofsim also have that role. They're not just meant to punish Paro, to break his will. They're also meant to demonstrate theology, both to Paro as well as to the Jewish people. So we don't have enough time to go through all the makos, but I just want to highlight two of them, in which the theological component is very, very palpable. It's not just putative, it's not just penal, it's not just psychological for Paro. It's theological, and to a degree, not just for Paro, but for the Jewish people who are learning about Hashem. Remember, the makos are also demonstrating monotheism to the Jews and to the rest of the world. So you have to be able to stretch your imagination beyond just seeing the makos as a punishment or an attack on Paro. So, for example, when the Arov descend on Mitzrayim, Hashem says, "Ki ein kamoni ki ani Hashem bekerev haaretz." There's actually a statement directed at Paro, but broadcast to everyone, that the Arov is not just meant to attack Paro, but to demonstrate, "Ki ani Hashem bekerev haaretz." Why is the word bekerev haaretz employed? Because Arov didn't really create anything new. But typically, in the natural world, predators don't predate side by side. You'll never find a bear and a wolf hunting together. A snake and a lion, they're normally enemies. They normally predate against each other, protect their territories, are in stiff competition for food. And the Arov was called Arov rather than Chayos because it was a mixture of all forms of animals that were attacking at once. And it demonstrated that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hidden hand exists within nature, very delicate balance, and when that hand is slightly altered, that interest and that maintenance slightly altered, the same forces of nature that normally create stability and division now can create chaos and mayhem. Or for example, the Arov always exists if you're in the forest or the jungle, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows man to create a boundary between civilization and the jungle. Now that boundary was overrun by the animals. Hashem is demonstrating that Hashem bekerev haaretz. You're not seeing anything new, you're just seeing me slightly tinker with some of the checks and balances and some of the very delicate calibrations that animals don't predate side by side. There's a balance between where human beings live and where the jungle exists, or the forest and the desert. Or for example, in Barad, Hashem says, Ki ein kamoni b'chol aretz, that I'm unique, I'm exclusive. Because Barad highlighted to the Egyptians that even though forces seem to be different and pagan minds think they come from different gods, that's the basis of paganism. We live in a divided world, so there must be a god for each part of our divided world. Barad showed the unity of Hashem. He had fire and water, are typically seen by pagans as stemming from different pagan gods, fire, water, earth, wind. All of a sudden, the Eshu Barad mit lakachas betoch ha'esh, with fire and water coexisting. And Hashem demonstrated this is the only makkah that the victims could escape. All the other makos you couldn't escape. You couldn't escape Dan, you couldn't escape Shechin, you couldn't escape Choshech. But Hashem gives a refuge for Egyptians who want to fear Hashem, they'll enter their homes and be safe. So they saw that God was not just a punisher, but was also a tzaddik. Hashem a tzaddik, Paro says, in the end of Parshas Va'era. So the word mofes, which appears in the beginning of Vayera, its first appearance, and there Rashi interprets it not just as a, because you're not really punishing Paro by converting the staff into a serpent, you're just demonstrating a kind of Baruch's authority, that also characterizes many of the makos that are also called mofsim. So Hashem says, I'm going to send all magi fosai, but the makos, that reminds us the makos are not just punitive. That's number one. Number two, what's also on display throughout the makos is tefillah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching Paro about the power of tefillah. Hashem is teaching, of course, us about the power of tefillah. We study tefillah in Sefer Bereishis, the Avos Davin. Many of the Shvatim were named after tefillah. Ki Shama Hashem, Apam Modes Hashem, Neftali Elokim Niftalti. But now tefillah is being updated. It's a few hundred years later. And there's tefillah that has very different connotations than tefillah in Bereishis. So you have to pay attention in the Makos when Moshe actually davens and what he's teaching them. Like, for example, famously, Paro asks Moshe to pray for the removal of Barad. And Moshe says, let me walk out of the city, and then I'll pray for Barad to be removed, because it's a pagan shrine, and placement and positioning in Egypt makes a difference. You can't just daven wherever you'd like. That's why Makom Kavua is so important, because you encounter Hashem in the same place. So if the place is riddled with filth and with theological deviation, you can't daven. Interestingly enough, the first makkah in which Moshe davens very, very pointedly is the makkah of Tzfardea. You have to ask yourself why that makkah is such an important moment of tefillah. So Paro comes to Moshe and he says, Ha'atiru el Hashem. Hatir is a lashon of tefillah. V'yaser ha'tzfardeim. He doesn't ask them to die, he wants them to be removed. Me'meni u'me'ami. V'yizbichul Hashem. And then you can offer your sacrifices. V'yam Moshe leParo hispa'er alai. Lemasai atir lach. Tell me when you want me to daven. We'll get back to this later. Paro says, I want the Tzfardim to be removed tomorrow. It takes a long time for all this to unfold. And finally, in Pasuk, let me find it here. Pasuk Chavav. No, it's the wrong Pasuk. Let me find it for a second. I'm sorry. Hatiru, Me'ami. I'm sorry. In that case, I read the wrong Rashi. In that case, okay, Moshe does not daven with the language of Lahatir. Paro asks, and Moshe is tzoek. But a little bit later, during the Arav, I confused the Arav and the Tzvardeh, because there are a lot of common themes. Moshe emerges, Vayetar El Hashem. And he davens, this is the first time that Moshe davens with Atira, with the language of Atira. He had suggested to Paro in Tzvardeh that he would daven through Atira, but he ultimately davens through a language of Tzeaka. However, in the Arov, he davens with the language of Vayetar El Hashem. Rashi has a very, very interesting language. It's two words. It may not be so exciting, but it's really important. Nis'ametz b'tfila. Vayetar Rashi had already described to mean a lot, extra effort, real investment. But Rashi says the investment is not in how much he davens, but how he invests emotionally and prepares for the davening and approaches davening. Nis'ametz b'tfila. Rashi says, if it would have meant he davened a lot, it would have said Vayatir. Vav yud ayin taf yud resh. So it says vayetar doesn't mean that he added a lot of tefillah. Achshav kishomer b'lashon vayifal mashma vayirbal hispalel. He puts a lot of effort into the tefillah. Now what's the difference between a lot of tefillah or a lot of effort into the tefillah? Well, it's the difference between paganism and monotheism. Paganism is a leveraging of God, where man controls God, and you control God by the offerings you give, by the virgins you sacrifice, by the way you appease God. Basically, you can manipulate God by feeding him, whether it's food, virgins, obedience. But the goal is to be able to affect mechanically. If I offer enough sacrifices, I can appease God and press a button and get him to do my bidding. It's very much where man is Masei de Adam, creates the pagan gods, and also dictates the terms of the relationship with the pagan gods. Moshe is trying to teach Paro that this is not paganism. And if you offer a lot of tefillos, a lot of korbanos, you may not succeed. So the question is, how your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how your ask is, whether you deserve it. So the preparation for tefillah is more important than an extra sacrifice or an extra virgin or an extra. Remember, Bilam is offering all these sacrifices. Maybe another sacrifice will work. Maybe another sacrifice will work. He doesn't get it, that it's the relationship and the engagement and the overall tenor of that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that will be effective in tefillah. So it's very important for Rashi to shift the language from vayatir to vayatar. Vayatir would mean five tefillahs, six tefillahs. That would still be within Pyro's cultural reference point. Vayatar means, how am I mentally preparing for tefillahs? And the mental preparation speaks to the relationship and the relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, rather than just, if I want to bribe someone, I don't have a relationship with that person, I just offer that person, the policeman, money, and I bribe him. So that's what paganism is, to bribe God. Whereas monotheism, not to bribe God, but to form a relationship with God. One of submission, one of hierarchy. So vayatir would be paganistic, another tefillah, another money, another wad of money. Vayatar is monotheistic, working hard in tefillah, this ametz v'tefillah, working hard in your approach to tefillah. Finally, very interesting, when the Arav come, this is now in Pasuk Chaf, Vayavo Arav Kaved Besa Paro, a heavy gang of animals, Uvachol Eretz Mitzrayim Tishaches Haaretz. The land will be destroyed. So it's a very strange language because it sounds like in the future, Tishaches Haaretz. So Rashi interprets it grammatically. It doesn't mean Tishaches Haaretz, it means Nishchas Haaretz, that the land was affected by the Arav. The problem is, if the Torah meant to say the land was affected or destroyed by the Arav, why doesn't it just say Nishchas Haaretz rather than Tishaches Haaretz, which makes us think that it's future, and Rashi has to reinterpret it grammatically to mean it's happening now in the present? The answer is that some of the Makos were also foreshadowing. They weren't just limited experiences, they were foreshadowing what would happen to Egypt in the future. And this is one of them. How did the Arav really affect the land? If I ask you what really affected the land of Egypt, not just the people of Egypt, which Makos would you say? Dam, Kinim, Ba'aretz, Barad, Arba. Those would be the four Makot that really affect the land itself, not just the people inhabiting the land. Arav, the animals didn't really ruin the land. Maybe they rampaged over a couple homes, but essentially the people were targeted, not the land. So there could be some effect on the land, but evidently Arav is a foreshadowing. That just like gangs of beasts will one have invaded Egypt, there will constantly be invasions of Egypt in the future that will really dismantle and affect the land. So the way that the Torah describes it, this is a makkah, but it's a makkah that's prescient, that's going to foreshadow future events in Egypt that will be punishment for their treatment of the Jewish people. Tishaches Haaretz. It's a word that on the one hand means current and present, but also grammatically, structurally, looks to the future. The Arav was just a model, and Rashi actually talks about the Arav as a metaphor for warfare, because you've got gangs of beasts invading the land, crossing the boundary between the jungle and the city, invading the country. So it's interesting, whenever you see a word that means one thing, and Rashi reinterprets it grammatically, well, why does the Torah use an awkward word that Rashi has to reinterpret, rather than just use the more direct word? So three very short Rashis, but each of them really packed with meaning. Number one, the word mofes means demonstrating theological realities, and it's used first by the Torah when Moshe converts the staff, but it's something which characterizes all the Makos. Some of them are more prominent than others. Number two, Moshe suggests he's going to daven through a language of Vayatar. He doesn't daven that way in Svardea. He does daven that way in Arov, but Rashi says it's not Vayatir, it's Vayatar. Vayatir would mean a lot of tefillah. Vayatar means a lot of effort into tefillah, maybe one tefillah, but with a lot of effort. And then finally, when Arav descends on Egypt, the Torah describes Tishaches Haaretz, the land itself will be affected. Rashi says, well, something happened in Arav that justifies this terminology, Nishchas Haaretz, but it's really Rashi doesn't say this, but it's really a foreshadowing of future invasions. And we know that very soon, after the Egyptian slavery, the Hittites invaded, and the Egyptian kingdom collapsed. And it's very, very unlikely that the current Egypt is an extension or continuation of the previous Egypt. It's probably, the previous Egypt was not Arabic. It was probably Cham, was probably African-based. And now Egypt has been conquered by the Arabian world, more so than any other countries in Africa. Most of the countries in Africa have become Muslims in recent memory. But Egypt was very, very early turned into a Muslim country, so it was captured from the original Cham descendants who enslaved the Jewish people. So this Tishaches Haaretz reminds us that what happens to a nation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine retribution from a nation, doesn't always happen in the immediate sense. Sometimes it happens hundreds of years later and acts foreshadow. People look to certain countries in Europe that were guilty of crimes throughout history, whether they're moral crimes against humanity, bleeding their countrymen dry, for personal gain and greed, whether it's Holocaust involvement, other areas, it's hard to know. We don't play God. But certainly you know that there's an accounting that takes place. I remember when I visited France, I was just shocked, morally repulsed by seeing the way the French monarchy conducted themselves through the medieval period and pre-modern period, the way in which it just bled the country dry, taxed the people through the nose for their own palaces of luxury and indulgence. It just really created a moral repugnance within me. How could you be so self-centered and so hedonistic at the cost of people who are really suffering? And you have to assume that at some point, the decline of the French Empire isn't somehow a compensation for the moral misbehavior for hundreds of years of people. So these things take time to emerge, but there's a political theater in which divine retribution takes place, not just the divine theological theater of Mitzrayim. Okay? Have a good Shabbos, everyone.